When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Hey everyone, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. I've been needing a quick getaway with my family, and the 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe is the perfect vehicle to take us there. It has standard third row seating, so I'm able to pack my entire family, plus pets, in the car while also having enough room for our camping essentials. Available H-Track all-wheel drive will get us through any dirt trails, and available dual wireless charging pads will ensure we never have to worry about getting stuck with a dead phone in the middle of nowhere. Visit HyundaiUSA.com. or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hey everybody, welcome to Movie Crush. Charles W. Chuck Bryant here at the home studio, the windowed studio, Ponce City Market, Atlanta, Georgia. Guest producer Ramsey, I guess you're not a guest producer anymore. Ramsey's a solid team member at this point. I'm sure he'll weasel his way on the mic at some point as well. So Ramsey's staring at me, and that means that this is the intro for the Ross Marquand episode on Die Hard. I got to tell you, people, I know I say kind of in all of these intros, what a nice person they were. And first of all, that's great because everyone I've had has turned out to be really good people, good folk. And it's nice. I haven't had any big jerks come through here. But Ross, boy, he is a super nice guy. And he has a very interesting life story and career path in acting that we get into. And I believe all of those things make up how Ross is, which is to say a very nice fella who you can just tell is imbued with gratitude about his career and about life. And I really admire his outlook on things. So we had a great time. This one is supersized. We talked about not only his life and career, we talked about impressions, of course, because he is one of the masters in. As everybody knows, it is no secret, I am nuts for impressions and impressionists, and he indulged me as much as we could without it completely overtaking the show. So look forward to James Gandolfini making an appearance, and John C. Reilly, and Brad Pitt, and Harrison Ford. They're all in here, everybody. It's good stuff. And then we zeroed in and geeked out big time on Die Hard. I got to say, it was great to sit down with someone who loves this movie as much as I do. We both had just watched it, and he took notes like a good student, which those always make for the best shows. And boy, we really get into it. The great, great film Die Hard from 1988. For his money, and maybe for my money too, the best action film of all time. So I don't want to keep you on ice any longer. Here we go with Ross Marquand on Die Hard. What did little Ross do growing up?
Little Ross,
what was your life like?
Into church, and then
what kind of church? What denomination?
Methodist.
Okay.
And then Boy Scouts. Uh-huh. Real big into Boy Scouts. Hence the camping and everything.
I grew up Baptist.
Ah, nice. Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah. And, you know, now I'm kind of buffet style with religion. And
right.
A little bit of everything.
Okay.
Whatever makes sense, whatever works for me. Some people think that's a cop-out, but I don't really care.
That's not a cop-out.
It works for me.
It's called opening your mind as you get older.
Yeah, that's how I like to look at
it.
Yeah. It's basically just, grew up the youngest of three boys. Scouting was always a big thing for my parents.
Uh-huh.
My father was an Eagle Scout, his twin brother, and I think their younger brother as well. So, of course, it was expected that we all get into that as well.
And did you achieve the highest level?
I made it to Eagle, yeah.
Wow, that's pretty cool. That's quite an achievement.
My brothers and I did, yeah. I mean, it was definitely at the time, because, you know, when you're in middle school and high school and you're, having to wear, like, these awful olive green pants and these khaki, with the handkerchief around your neck. Like,
right.
You feel like a dork already in middle school with pimples and braces and glasses.
Yeah.
And, the last thing you want to do, because our troop required us to go to school once a week dressed in our uniform to kind of, I suppose, raise awareness.
Is that the embarrassment badge?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. I really don't know, looking back, why they made us do that. But every Friday, I think, or maybe it was every other Friday, but we were expected to wear our uniform, and it was, I suppose you could have like lied about it, but I was never really good about lying about that, so I just would always wear it and get so much crap for it.
There were probably other kids though, right? Or no?
Yeah, I mean, like, there was probably about maybe 10 kids at our school so not a really good ratio.
Yeah.
So unless you were in class with them and you could like team up and be like, yeah, we're nerds together.
Yeah, you're the only guy.
You were just the lone nerd out. Yeah.
Yeah. My nephew, I think, went all the way through Eagle Scout.
Cool.
And it is an achievement. And it's like, I think to stick through it when it's not the 1950s and you might get made fun of a little bit. Is even more an achievement. It speaks. It's one of those things that as an adult you can look back on and be like, yeah, I'm actually super proud of that now.
Well, yeah. And I think, to be honest, like that alienation and being picked on in middle school and high school, as rough as it was at the time, I'm actually glad for it. I'm glad for my brothers beating me up.
Right.
I'm glad for the harassment I got from my friends at school because I don't know. I think that kind of, it's maybe a little masochistic, but I think it toughens you up for the inevitable rejection of Hollywood. You know what I mean?
Right.
If you've dealt with that your whole life and then you go to Hollywood and you face literal nonstop daily rejection.
That's tough stuff.
Yeah, it's great. You kind of get toughened up.
When did you start acting?
I mean, professionally, probably around 17, 18.
Really?
And then, I've been acting in some way, shape, or form since I was about 9.
Uh-huh.
But I think the first time I really tried to like do professional work was about 18 years old.
Was that in your family at all, or entertainment in the least?
Yeah. My cousin is an amazing international DJ. He spins Brazilian neo soul and funk.
Really?
Yeah, he's pretty incredible. And his father and mother were involved in like Mighty Wind, that movie.
Yeah.
That style of like, I'm trying to think, Mannheim Steamroller.
Uh-huh. Mannheim Steamroller is like the Christmas.
Not them. What's their, I'm thinking of like a band that they sounded like, but it was kind of very much
Mama's
Mighty
and
Wind.
The Papas?
No. I'm trying to think of a different one, but yeah, something with an M, I think.
I'm on the M train.
Yeah, we're on the M train. But I think, what was it? Anyway, they were just very much into that sort of, eight or nine piece.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone plays a guitar.
Right.
There's a very light drum in the background.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's how my aunt and uncle met, was in this band.
Right.
So music has always very much been, and my other cousin, their daughter, was involved in dance and ballet, and then later became a capoeira instructor.
Oh, cool.
It's very much in our family's blood, I suppose.
Yeah. Are you a musician as well?
No, I wish I was.
I can
kind of sing a little bit, but I mean, I can carry a tune, but like, I'm actually trying to actively learn how to play guitar and mandolin.
Right.
Mandolin, especially when I'm in the cabin, because
you should
play mandolin while you're in the cabin, I think. And then I'm playing the handpan.
Okay. What's that?
It's actually, if I may.
Yes, you may.
there's an app. I have a handpan at home, but
I think I've heard of that.
It's these lovely, I better turn up the.
I I'm about to fall asleep.
Yeah, I know, right? It's very relaxing, and after a long day, I like to just play that. And
that's cool. Is it a sort of a take on a steel drum?
Yeah, but yeah. It's very much found in like East Asia. But this is very much a variation of like what you might find in Caribbean islands as
that's
well.
Cool.
You know, so it's great.
But you have a real one.
I do have a real a big like.
I thought you sit around on your phone.
Yeah, I do that. I do that too when I'm on set and I need to chill out.
But, yeah,
yeah,
that's pretty relaxing. I bet
it is.
Yeah. That's cool. I think people should. I think it's cool that, I mean, how old are you? Like mid-30s?
Yeah, 36, yeah.
Yeah, like it's not too late to learn a new thing.
Yeah.
You know, and I think a lot of people get to a certain age like, oh, well, I can't learn to play the piano now.
Yeah, I'm trying to learn.
But you can.
I can. Thank you. I'm trying to. I mean, it's also like muscle memory too, more than anything.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Well, and guitar, I played guitar since I was 12.
Oh, wow.
And remarkably not as good as somebody who has been playing guitar for 35 years.
Okay, gotcha.
Pretty decent, like, rhythm guitar player, but I can't string three notes of a solo together.
Wow.
Just never have been able to.
Yeah.
But can play pretty good rhythm guitar, and guitar is just all about repetition and, building up those calluses.
It's the calluses.
Yeah, you just got to kind of keep at it. Oof. And then before you know it, you're like, oh, wait a minute, I have fingers of steel now.
Yeah, yeah.
And just learn those chords. You can teach yourself.
I'm working on it.
Yeah. It's great. And I played a little bit of mandolin, but.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, just chord strumming and stuff.
Yeah.
Nothing like the picking.
It's tough because it's all reverse of guitar a little bit, you know, the way you play upwards as opposed to downwards guitar.
Yeah.
So that's the thing that's kind of tripping me up, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Trying to learn both at the same time.
Yeah, it's tricky.
And the hand pan.
Yeah.
That says a lot about you.
I'm in the cabin alone a lot, so, you know. Yeah.
Well, so tell me about how you got into Walking Dead, because for someone, you were cast then, I guess, when you were in your early 30s.
Yeah.
And that's kind of late to get your first big break like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely feel very lucky. I had literally given up acting.
Really?
About a month or five or six weeks before I got the part.
Uh-huh. And how do you give up acting? Do you just tell yourself, like, I'm just done?
About $100,000 worth of debt, no job, no girlfriend, no career to speak of. I mean, like the biggest thing I had done at that point was a very small, and I mean very small guest star role on Mad Men where I was playing Paul.
Yeah, you played Paul Newman.
Newman, like off in the distance.
I remember that,
like,
man.
A very small speck in the distance. And
that's kind of cool though.
It's kind of cool. It's a neat bit of, you know, trivia for that time. And that was it. You know, the rest of it was just mostly indie projects or voiceover work where, you know, it was neat to do stuff, but you didn't make more than 75 or 100 bucks a day.
Right.
And anybody who's ever lived in LA for any amount of time knows that you just can't live on that.
Yeah.
So I after about 10 years, I was like, okay, I get it. It's
right.
Not going to happen for me.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I didn't know if I was going to give up acting entirely, but just film and TV for that time. I mean, I just felt like I needed to step away from it. And if theater came calling or writing or photography, which I love doing too, I could still pursue that. But
was that what was your career plan? Was it that?
Yeah. I mean, the plan was not great because I just decided to move to New York, which is even more expensive. But I was going to switch with my friend. She was going to take my spot. I was going to take her spot. We were
going to
switch for about 6 or 7 months. And we were just going to try out a new city.
That's a great idea.
Because it was a very comparable rent. I figured, well, I'm broke here. Might as well be broke in a city that I really want to be in.
At least there you can get like a dollar slice of pizza for lunch.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was a pretty sweet setup. I was going to have 3 roommates. And I was like, great. That sounds perfect. You know, like, let me just live this really bohemian, broke-ass artist life.
Yep.
And I felt great. It was ironic because I'd given up acting in smaller waves twice before, one at the 5-year mark, one at the, I think, 8-year mark or 7 or 8-year mark. And those just felt awful. I felt like I was tucking my tail between my legs and going back to Colorado. And it was a failure.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a real acknowledgement that I had failed at my dream.
Yeah.
And then when this, you know, decision to give up happened, it was actually a cathartic one.
Right.
I felt great. I felt like this giant albatross was lifted off my shoulders, and I felt like the thing that defined me, being an actor my whole life, this thing that I thought was in me and I had it to be this, it was gone now. And it was nice because, like, I didn't have to be this thing anymore.
Yeah.
The expectation from friends and family, they were like, you're going to get it.
Right.
And then at the 5-year mark, they're like, hey, did you get it? And you're like, no, still trying. Oh, okay.
Right.
And then at the 7-year mark, they're like, hey, when are you going to come back home?
Yeah. And you're like, I don't even want to go home for Christmas anymore.
Yeah. And I couldn't afford to go home a lot of times, you know, and they would, my parents would offer and sometimes I'd take them up on it, but a lot of times I would, the last Thanksgiving before I decided to give up, I did a medical study. I was doing a lot of medical studies at the time to pay the bills. So I was trying out non-FDA approved drugs in my body to pay the bills because when you're broke, you do stupid shit.
What kind of, what was that like?
This was a really rough one. This was the roughest one I ever did and the last one I'll hopefully ever have to do in my life.
Yeah.
But this was to test the efficacy of this non-FDA approved drug on MRSA patients. And MRSA, if it's not detected within the first 3 weeks, usually die. So, and this was a particular nasty strain of meth-resistant staph infection. And so they tested it on healthy patients. Mm-hmm. And of the 20 people who made it into the study, only 4 people remained at the end. 2 of those people were placebos. So they were getting sugar pills. We had the drips. We had the IVs in our arm 24/7 for 30 days straight.
Holy shit.
We were in there. We couldn't leave the facility for 30 days. We were allowed to walk around for 15 minutes. Outside.
Oh, my God.
So it was like being in prison.
Yeah.
Especially because a lot of my co-patients were ex-cons.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, I mean, it was me and this very, very gaunt model. Uh-huh. And she and I kind of made a pact because we were so broke but so determined not to leave. Because they were paying us a whopping $3,600.
Oh, jeez.
And even though everyone else had either asked to leave or had been asked to leave because people were passing out in the bathrooms, hitting their heads on the toilet seats. They were, you know, going into convulsions. I mean, like people were having such an adverse reaction to these drugs. It felt like a little animal was inside of our bellies trying to get its way out. It
sounds like a film script.
Yeah. It was I'm definitely working on that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow, man.
It was like a sci-fi type of thing.
And are they just charting side effects at this point?
Yeah. And they're also just seeing like how well it affects your nervous system,
right,
and if it actually helps with any white blood cell increase.
Even though you're healthy, it's not like they gave you MRSA.
Right. You know, well, but ironically, I did get MRSA from gym equipment like a year and a half later, which is the irony of ironies.
Wow.
Yeah. And that was brutal. That was
Holy
very hellish.
Cow.
So, yeah, MRSA's no joke. And I feel like this is like a PSA for MRSA all of a sudden. But yeah, it was a dark time, and I couldn't go home for Thanksgiving that year because it was over. The study ended, I think, like November 30th.
And you were just a wreck.
I was a wreck, and my parents kept calling, like, what are you doing? And I said, I'm working on a medical drama. I'm doing a film.
Oh, man.
And I was lying, but kind of not.
You were working on a medical drama.
And they were like, well, we're happy for you, but we wish we could see you for Thanksgiving. I'm like, yeah, they're working straight through it. I'm sorry.
Oh, man.
And it was tough to lie to them and say, like, I wish I could be there, but I don't have any money, and I'm doing medical studies to pay the bills now, you know?
No wonder you're such a nice guy.
I've never told my parents this. So
really?
If they hear this, they're going to be like, what the hell? Like, why did you do that?
No, but no wonder you're such a good dude. Like you had a real life and real life experiences before you achieve success. And I imagine you're very grateful.
Very, very grateful.
And grounded.
I try to be as grounded as I can. I mean, like, you know, I still make a shit ton of mistakes, and I try to be the best person I can be. But, like, you know, it is tough when you're that broke for that long.
Yeah, man.
That much insecurity and doubt going into, you know, 0 to 60. All of a sudden, you're on this world-renowned show that is this thing that is beyond anything that's really existed on TV before. I mean,
so how did that happen? Give me that story.
I gave up and then I felt great. And I felt honestly like it was the most amazing thing. I felt like I could do anything after I gave up acting. And it was wonderful. And I turned on Netflix one day because I was unemployed and I didn't care. And I could just watch, you know, TV at 2 in the afternoon. And I saw that Walking Dead season 4 had just arrived on Netflix.
Had you already watched the show?
Yeah, I was a huge fan of the show before it.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
And then I saw that Netflix was showing season 4. It was showing season 4 was out. And I said, oh, you know what? I haven't seen season 4. Let me just watch this and binge it. And I watched the entire season in a weekend. And I was really happy with the new direction they were taking. And Scott Gimple had just taken over as showrunner. And I really loved where the show was going.
Uh-huh.
And I just said, wow, that's great. Can't wait to see where they go with season five. And that's literally, I just, you know, said that in my head and then went about the rest of my week. And then about a week later, I got a call from my manager and she said, we got you another audition for The Walking Dead. And I'd auditioned for it twice already.
Oh, okay.
And I said, oh man, you know what? I'm so sorry. I need to refuse this. I'm really sorry, but I need to take a step away from acting. I'm taking a break indefinitely. Yeah. And she's like, what? I'm like, yeah, I know. I'm sorry. I can't do this again. Mm-hmm. I can't do the rejection. I can't do the, you know, memorizing everything, going with, you know, choices and then getting close to booking something and then getting rejected. It's a heartbreaking profession.
Oh yeah, man.
And she said, we worked really hard to get you this, please go in. And so kind of out of obligation to her and everyone else, I said, okay.
And because I guess you kind of forgot to tell her that you had quit acting.
I really had. I mean, like, I think that I was just on such a kick of like, screw it. I really didn't think to call my manager and tell them that I decided to give up acting. I truly. And I went to the audition, and that's the only time in my life where I can honestly say I did not care if I booked a part or not.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that I didn't come in prepared. I still memorized the lines. I still came in and gave it a go because that's just, I mean, I wanted to show respect to that casting office who's brought me in a million times, and they're wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
They brought me in so many times. And I just didn't care about the outcome. Whether I booked it or not was irrelevant.
Yeah.
The first thing I thought about after I left the audition was, what am I going to have for dinner?
Right.
You know, literally. And
I've heard similar stories, you know, there's something to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you're not, I mean, I think when you're a broke actor and every job could mean, oh, I can pay rent for the next few months.
That
or
desperation,
I can put
yeah.
food on the table. And luckily I was by myself. I can't mm-hmm. imagine what it's like for people with a spouse or kids or whatever, you know? But for me, it was a full resignation of hope.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't care anymore.
Wow.
I was gone, totally, totally gone. I was already in New York by that point, mentally.
Yeah.
And didn't hear anything for a week. And usually in the acting world, like if you don't hear within the first couple of days, if you got the part, you didn't get it.
Right.
But it was a week later. I was sick as a dog. It was my birthday.
Mm.
And I was just sick as all get out. Not from MRSA. This was something totally different, but truly just like yakking and feeling awful. And I got a call around 5 o'clock that night from my manager. And she said, are you sitting down? I said, I'm lying down. What's up? Just sweating and feeling awful. And she's like, well, you just booked the show.
Wow.
And I shot out of bed and like immediately felt like $1 million.
It Man.
Was incredible what that mental boost just did for my body.
Amazing.
And then a week later, I was here in Atlanta shooting the show.
Wow.
So
that is something else.
It's crazy. I don't know what the lesson there is, though.
Yeah.
Because, like, the lesson isn't never give up in your dreams because I fully gave up.
Right.
I think the lesson is give up the expectation.
Mm.
That you have to get something out of this, whether mm-hmm. it's love life or career or whatever.
Right.
Once you separate yourself from the expectation of this thing, I need to have this thing because this defines me.
Yeah.
I have no idea if I'm going to be an actor in 5 years. I don't know if I'm going to be in this industry in 5 years.
Yeah.
I have no idea. I'd like to be. Mm-hmm. I enjoy it now, but life might take me a totally different path, and I might decide to travel for the next 10 years.
Yeah.
I might decide to, you know, meditate in India for the next 10 years. Uh-huh. I have no idea. I have no idea. But I think just keeping those options open,
mm-hmm.
you leave life open to surprise you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's the real key of all life is just like, don't think that you know exactly where your life's going to go because I guarantee you don't.
Yeah.
You know, and the best surprises come when you give that up.
That is good stuff, dude. Congratulations.
Thanks.
That's really great.
Thank you.
I love stuff like that. I don't want to do a little dance monkey dance thing, but I would love to talk about the impressions.
Okay.
If you don't mind.
Of course.
Is that a thing that you're like, oh,
no,
come
no,
on,
no, it's
again.
Fine. It's fine.
Because I grew up... I'm 47, and I grew up on the tail end of, like, Rich Little.
Rich Little, of course.
And when I was a kid, it just enthralled me.
Yeah.
My brother and I both listening to, like, The First Family record and The First Family Rides Again.
Yeah.
Watching Rich Little. Anytime there was an impressionist, it just knocked my socks off. There's something about it.
Yeah.
I think for some people, it just – there's something in the brain that it triggers this – dopamine shot or something.
Yeah.
And I know other people, they're like, yeah, whatever. But man, it gets me. And had Kevin Pollak in the studio.
Kevin's great.
And Kevin's great, and he's a bit older than us, so he's got these great, like, Johnny Carson and Alan Arkin and some, you know, a little more old school guys.
Right.
But where did that start for you? Did you always do voices?
Mine started with Johnny Carson, too.
Uh-huh.
Being the youngest of three, I think you're always the entertainer. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you have to be the tension breaker in the family.
I'm the youngest of three, too.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, so it's like, if you're not... If you want to avoid getting beaten down
right.
by your brothers, you know, you gotta make them laugh. And, you know, money was, you know, sometimes tight in our family. And
yeah.
we weren't like destitute by any means. But my dad worked his ass off to put food on the table mm-hmm. for us. And, you know, it was tense sometimes,
yeah.
you know, sometimes it was tense. And so I think that I acknowledged early on that there were very few things that made my parents laugh more than Johnny Carson.
Uh-huh.
And when I saw them laugh, like, heartily at Johnny Carson, and I think he was, you know, it was not like it is nowadays. I think Johnny Carson came on around, like, 8 or 9
mm-hmm.
back then. So The Tonight Show was actually a little bit on the earlier side.
Yeah.
Because I think people realize, like, why would I stay up until 10:30 for this, you know?
Yeah.
And Johnny, you just come out there and wow, you know, he just really just come out and just, and my parents would eat that up.
Yeah.
And my brother would sometimes do Ed McMahon. Yes. You know, and it would make my parents laugh. You
yeah.
know, like they loved it. And it wasn't good, I'm sure, when I was like 8 or 9, whenever I was trying this, like
uh-huh.
it probably wasn't a very good Johnny Carson, but I would do the golf swing and
yeah.
everything. And it made them laugh. And I think even just that small contribution I could make as the youngest of three and feeling already kind of meek and insecure,
mm-hmm.
It made me feel good, made me
yeah.
feel confident. And as time went on, I just mostly did it for shits and giggles.
Uh-huh.
But then I realized once I moved out to LA, you could actually make a profession of that.
Right. Just general voice work or, hey, be this person.
Be this person, sound a little bit like this person,
gotcha.
Emulate this, and can you actually copy this voice because we want to do this for a cartoon
uh-huh.
or we want to do this for an actual film for voice matching work, which is a big thing. And I made most of my money between cater waitering, medical studies, and voice matching work.
Right.
Amongst many other odd jobs. That's you know, where I made most of my money before I got on this show.
Now, would you work at it like, because I've always done voices, but not like, I'm drinking, hanging out with friends
uh-huh.
and am telling a story about somebody and we'll do the voice.
Yeah.
But I never like worked on it. And all my friends always laugh because I do good Chuck impressions, which is to say I could never do it on stage and people would say, that's great, but I emulated it enough to where everyone knows and it gets a laugh.
Oh, okay, yeah.
You know, but I never sat in front of the mirror and said, all right, I'm going to really try and hone my Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah, I was going back to the Boy Scout days, a really nerdy kid. I mean, like, imagine glasses, braces, pimples, and then once every week or so having to wear a Boy Scout uniform to school, like, got picked on a fair amount.
Right.
And I wasn't like...
And your Johnny Carson didn't stop that?
No. I wasn't friendless. I definitely had a lot of friends. It was just that, you know, you're the butt of a lot of jokes.
Yeah.
If you're that guy. And the armor that I would put on would be, let me be the class clown
uh-huh.
as much as possible. And I think that for me, it was more as a necessity
mm-hmm.
to you know, work on these things because that was the only way I would get out of being... constantly picked on.
Yeah, interesting.
You know, and
so they appreciated it?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, like, once I got good at, like, I did, like, John Travolta after Pulp Fiction was big in middle school and high school, you know, try to do the Vincent Vega, you know.
And would people say, like, people that normally might pick on you say, like, Ross, do the thing.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
And I'm sure that they were only being nice to me because they could make me
right.
do the thing, but, like, it was fine because
sure.
I wasn't getting picked on, you
yeah.
know, for that brief amount of time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. And you've gotten a lot of notoriety recently, too. It seems like the Ross Marquand impression thing has just sort of exploded on late-night TV and, of course, all the things you've been doing lately with it.
Thank you, yeah.
So it's kind of cool, huh?
It's neat. It's opened up some doors for me, for sure. And that's been very helpful, yeah.
What is, the one that kind of knocked me out, and part of it is the... for me, it's weird, like, listening to records when you're a kid, because part mm-hmm. of it for me is always the mannerisms and the expressions can lend so much to it. So somebody like a Rich Little, like listening to albums, you lose all that, but he still managed to get it across. But you're definitely one of the more physical impressionists.
I have to do that. Because I feel like
you sort of inhabit it, right?
Yeah. And I feel like you really do have to become, you have to physically become the person you're impersonating, because like every instrument, you know, flutes produce different sounds than saxophones, you know, and they produce different sounds because of the way the curvature of the brass is, you know, made. And
yeah,
and you press on this hole, it produces a different sound versus, you know, this flange or whatever the hell it's called.
Right.
You know, like, it produces different sounds. So when I'm like, for example, like James Gandolfini is a perfect example. Like,
I put my face forward, and I shit on my neck, and I talk to my nose. What
you
is
look
this?
Like when you're doing it. That's it's such a transformative process.
Well, it's all just mechanics, I think, you know.
And he's right up in here. And when Brad Pitt
just barely moves his mouth, yeah?
Yeah, he's just one of my favorites that you do.
Thanks. I mean, he's just like, he very much like, he doesn't even open his mouth very much, yeah?
Yeah.
He's a dabber when he moves his hands. He's like this, yeah?
Yeah, and the pointing and stuff.
Yeah,
so on point. Oh,
you know, and it's like it's all in mechanics, I think, for me.
Yeah, but that makes sense because the way, like you said, the way you speak has to do with whether or not you've got your head to the side or you're slumping or slouching, and
yeah,
that really kind of drives someone's vocal range, I think.
Definitely.
So I can't imagine someone doing it just kind of standing there in a regular pose.
Oh, and, I can. I don't know. I mean, some of my impressionist friends can do that.
Really?
They can just, you know, be as they normally are, as you know, they just sit in a sound booth like this, and they can do that. Uh-huh. I can't. I have to fully become that person.
Yeah.
You know?
Have you ever done it on stage? Like, did you ever do stand-up or anything like that?
Yeah, I've done that before. I've done a lot of impression stuff on stage. You know, stand-up was always something that, like, that was like my white whale, like in my Moby Dick. I could never, it was always so elusive. Like, I tried it a few times and I was never great at it because I got so scared, you know. But improv, I did a lot of improv, and that always came up in the improv. Like, somehow it would just naturally go towards, hey, Jason Statham, how would you, you know? Like,
all right, come on now.
So
I just become a little kid, man. I did the same thing. I just giggled nonstop when Pollock was in there.
Oh, my God.
At one point, I was like, just do the rest of the interview as Alan Arkin, and I'll just be happy.
His Alan Arkin is so good, too.
Yeah, it's pretty spot on.
God, he's good. And his walk-in. I'll admit, like, his walk-in and Jay Moore's walk-in, I beg, borrow, and steal profusely from them.
Well, everyone's got a walk-in.
For sure. But but their walk-in really honed in on, for me, like, because, you know, there's people who do walk-in really well, like the two of them, and people who do it, you know, kind of just wild and over the place.
Sure.
And there's some, look at the gravel. It's all about this gravel voice. Pow. Chuck, you know what I'm saying? Here's the thing. You know, and that, when I heard that, I think Jay Moore was the one that really got the gravel.
Yeah,
and
he was
good.
And I
was like, whoa, that's it.
Because he worked with him on, I think both of them worked on that movie Suicide Kings together.
Yeah.
Was Jay Moore? I knew Jay Moore was in that, but wasn't Kevin in that too, I think?
I can't remember.
But regardless, I know they both all worked together. And, and I think that just spending enough time together, like that's where it just seeps in fully, you know?
Yeah, and I feel like Kevin may have mentioned this, that whenever you meet people that who you've done, you know, have you ever had that experience?
Oh, yeah.
I feel like they never cop to the fact that you do it right.
Yeah.
Or for any impressionist, is probably like, nah, you didn't quite get it.
I made the mistake of doing my Larry David for Larry David once pressure, and it did, you know, he was polite about it, but he was like, not your best. And it just it crushed me. So after that experience.
No, but that's such a Larry David thing to say.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, he's not going to fawn over that.
No. And I just like, I'm never going to do that again. Actually, Norman on our show has been asking me to do, because he knows that I do an impression of him.
Of Norman Reedus?
He's been asking me to do it for years. I'm like, I can't. Because if you don't like it, you're gonna look at me different the rest of the, you're not going to like me.
Right.
You know.
Can you do it for me now?
No.
Okay. You haven't publicly done that one.
No,
at all.
No.
Gotcha.
No.
So you're avoiding any probably Walking Dead cast members.
Yes. Correct.
All right.
I mean, I've done Andy, Lincoln, and Norman for many years before I even got on the show. But I will never do it for them.
Who do you do it for? Just at home?
I've done Norman for Andy and a few other cast members, but I don't mess with that.
I gotcha. Yeah. Do you have a favorite?
I love Well, Walken's great too, but I love like James Gandolfini and McConaughey. McConaughey just has, because he can make anything sound interesting.
Yeah.
He just has his way of like getting right back into his voice right there in the back of the throat and just like pontificating about life, you know? Like, I can't believe that we're here and we're recording sound. We're right here in the booth. It's all foam around us and it's real nice.
Oh, you know, yeah.
You're like, I could just listen to him talk all day.
Me
you know?
Too. I could listen to you talk like him all day.
Okay, cool.
Well, and that's one of the things too with an impression, like especially for comedians, you also have to be funny. Like you have to be good at it. You have to inhabit it. You have to be funny or else it doesn't fly on stage, I think.
Right.
And I've seen some impressionists that nail it, but they're to bring comedy into it, it's a whole different thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's I think it's going back to the cornerstone of good improv, which is just take these incredible actors and throw them into absurd situations.
Mm-hmm.
That's when the best stuff comes.
Yeah.
You know, Christopher Walken talking to his mechanic about, you know, his leaky brake fluid.
Like, yeah.
What's going on here? It's leaking all over the floor. I can't be safe. You know, like, it's so stupid, but like,
man, you can just imagine
Walken talking to his mechanic. It's like, you know, getting into a fight about that and then talking about the Jets for an hour.
Right.
You
know, like, did you know that Pollock had a podcast called Talkin' Walken?
Oh, I think I heard about this, yeah.
It was pretty short-lived. He didn't do it too long, but it was basically a show for whatever, an hour, where he would just have conversations with people as Christopher Walken.
Oh,
but just everyday shit, you know?
I got to listen to that. Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, I listened to a few after he told me about
it. He's told me some stories.
Do you guys know each other?
Well, just tangentially. I mean, like, we worked together on this show that I did a few years ago called Impress Me, and he was a guest star on that. And then we did a podcast last year for Doug Benson. But, like,
he had
the best stories about Christopher Walken. Like, I would just be like, you know, kind of.
I was the same way, man.
Oh, man. Yeah. I love that. I love that stuff. You
know? He's had such a wide-ranging career and worked with so many people. Like, I mean, he worked with Walter Matthau.
Yeah.
And
oh, right.
Does Walter Matthau and worked with Alan Arkin. And
whoa.
It's kind of crazy.
Didn't think about that.
He was one of the sons and
Grumpy Old Men.
Yeah, Dirty Old Men.
Dirty Old Grandpas.
So did you guys, like, bond over impressions or talk shop?
Yeah.
Is that what happens?
Most definitely. Yeah. And then the nature of that show Impressed Me was that we were two impressionists who were trying to be taken seriously as dramatic actors.
Uh-huh.
Irony of ironies. And that was a show produced by Rainn Wilson. So he was friends with Kevin and he, you know, came on the show and it was great because he's a wealth of knowledge and a wealth of impressions, you know.
Do you feel like you have to put a lot of work into it, or can you kind of do somebody pretty quickly and then work on it?
Some people come relatively quick. Like John C. Reilly came
Your John C. Reilly is ridiculous.
Oh, thank you. I hope that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's nuts because that voice is so iconic.
Yeah.
And that came to you quickly?
Well, because I had just finished an audition for Nickelodeon for some cartoon. This was like 5 years ago. And then I got a call and they said, hey, they want you to come back and do a voice match for Wreck-It Ralph, for John C. Reilly. Can you do a John C. Reilly? And I was like, oh, I've never tried John C. Reilly. And I really hadn't. I was like, oh, shit, what am I going to do?
Right.
And on the drive, I was like, okay, I'll do my best, you know, whatever. And I just was driving over there as fast as I could. And I was like, oh, my God, I don't know what I'm going to do here. there it is, kind of. And then I just kind of, you know, played around with, like, this gravelly,
you bet your bottom dollar that's what you're talking about right there.
And my Reilly is definitely more Steve Brule. Prefer.
Yeah,
Brule
is the best.
You know, I could definitely slip into just a normal, just John C. Reilly right there. You know what I mean?
But, he's one of my favorites to do, too.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
I mean, I could do this for the next hour.
Okay.
But we've got to get into Die Hard.
Let's get into Die Hard.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Hey, this is Jody Sweeten from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. As a nostalgic voice from your past, I'm here to remind you that amongst the stressful and chaotic existence we live in 2024, you deserve to get away. It's time for a vacation, no matter when you're hearing this. And let me tell you how you'll get there. The 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe. Want to bring the family to the mountains with the Santa Fe's available H-Track all-wheel drive? Well, it's got standard third-row seating and available dual wireless charging pads for the kids who just want to stare at their phone and not talk to you. You know what I mean. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This summer, click into Memorial Day savings at the Home Depot and get after those outdoor projects with some serious cordless power from Ryobi. Tackle more than half an acre of grass with the convenience and gas-like power of the Ryobi 40-volt battery-powered mower. Leaves and debris are no match for the 40-volt power of the Ryobi leaf blower. No cords, no gas, no hassle. Tidy up those flower beds and keep your walkways looking sharp with Ryobi's 40-volt cordless string trimmer. Yard work, done and done. Click into Memorial Day savings happening now at your cordless power source, the Home Depot. Shop now at the Home Depot or homedepot.com. How doers get more done.
So,
yeah.
Die Hard 1988. I was a junior in high school.
Okay.
Kind of prime time for Die Hard.
Yeah.
Based on the novel Nothing Lasts Forever, directed by John McTiernan, written by Jeb Stuart.
And Stephen D'Souza, right?
Oh, was there a co-writer?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Well, hey.
I could be wrong, but.
I'd take your word for it.
Oh, well. Yeah.
That sounds familiar. Right. I was a huge Moonlighting fan going into this film. Very, very much into that show. Mm-hmm. And so this was kind of the first big action or kind of big movie. I think he'd done like one other film, but it was, they took a chance on Bruce Willis, which is kind of funny to think about now.
Oh, it's hilarious.
As the star of an action film.
Yeah.
And, I don't remember my first experience seeing it for some reason, but do you?
Yeah. I saw it on TV, edited for TV.
Oh, that's a shame.
Truly. But at the same time, hilarious because my brothers and I, you know, we would sneak down and watch so much TV when we weren't supposed to. When my parents went to bed, that was when we
life happened.
Oh yeah, like that was. I was raised on TV. Like my parents did their best to make sure we went outside, and we did. Mom and Dad, I'm sorry if I'm, you know, they were great parents, and they definitely, you know, made sure we got plenty of exercise and everything. But whenever possible, my brothers and I would be in front of that TV watching the Addams Family, watching Star Trek: Next Generation.
Sure.
You know, everything we could get our hands on. We would watch. Mm-hmm. And honestly, Die Hard would come on with some frequency, surprisingly. I mean, I think it just did really well.
Yeah.
And so as long as it was edited for content, they just felt comfortable showing it, you know, once a month, it felt like on Channel 20, KTVD, Denver.
Yeah.
And oh my gosh, I'll never forget that very first time I heard the iconic line from Bruce Willis. The yippee-ki-yay, but they edited it for content, of course.
What did they say?
And the funniest thing is, like, this is what I do now for work sometimes is voice matching. So, like, the guy they hired to do his voice match was god-awful.
Yeah.
Sounded nothing like Bruce Willis.
Oh, so you'll do stuff like that?
Yeah, I do that
like,
a lot.
For, like, airplane movies and...
Yeah, precisely.
Okay. Interesting.
And it sounds, you know, it's just Bruce Willis. He's like, yippee-ki-yay. And then you hear the dude who's doing his voice match go, Mr. Falcon. Like... Didn't sound anything like Bruce
like
Willis.
Like paging Pee-wee Herman.
Yeah, exactly. Yippee-ki-yay, Mr. Falcon. Like, Mr. Falcon. So funny that that's what they chew. I mean, like, yeah, I suppose phonetically, and you look at his mouth,
right,
it's kind
of
like Mr. Falcon, but I love that Mr. Falcon was the choice.
Yeah, my buddy Brett and I always laugh at Do the Right Thing on TV was Mickey Ficky.
Oh, yeah.
Instead of motherfucker.
Monkey Feather is oftentimes another one, like snakes in a plane. So.
Really? Well, Monkey Feather?
Monkey Feather, yeah.
That's hysterical.
Which makes no sense. Right. Not as Mr. Falcon, but
yippee-ki-yay,
Mr. Falcon. Yeah, yeah.
That's great. It should have just cut to a shot of Rickman just being like, "What did he say?"
No, does not compute.
I had a feeling you had some Die Hard in you.
Oh yeah,
impression wise. So I was a huge Moonlighting fan. Obviously, Die Hard. Right at the beginning of the movie, starts out with that. It's such an efficient script, and it runs like a Swiss watch. From the very first scene, he sets up the fist with your toes.
Fist with your toes.
Which you don't know at the time, yep, sets up a major, major plot point, which is why is he barefoot and what does that mean later on?
There's foreshadowing throughout this film.
Yeah.
From Ode to Joy.
Yeah.
There's little just notes of Ode to Joy coming through.
Yeah, yeah.
About six times before it's finally, you know, the big reveal with the vault opening.
Yep.
But these beautiful little notes, just hints of Ode to Joy coming through. And it's always when Rickman's
I noticed that last night, too.
You know?
Yeah.
And even when Argyle, the limo driver, he says, there's a great foreshadowing moment there when he's like, you know, so you're going to, he's playing the song, and he's like, so what are you going to do? You're going to, you know, music's going to fade up, and you're going to run into her arms, and
right.
And he's like, something like that, Argyle, you know? And of course, what happens at the end of the movie? There's foreshadowing throughout. The script is so taught, like you said, and it's so well written.
Yeah.
The editing is on point.
Mm-hmm.
Sound design's perfect. Both the music and the sound effects, both practical and after the fact. Like I stand by this. Like, I believe this is the best action movie of all time. For various reasons.
Sure.
Yeah.
And that's what hit me last night too, because it's one of 180s/ mid-90s action films.
Yeah.
But it cut through all the chaff and stands alone, or, you know, almost alone.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to look at it and say, why? And when you watch it, it's because it's great. It's great acting. It's the script is, like you said, just so tight. The editing is perfect. Everything worked. It's no accident that Die Hard became Die Hard.
Yeah. And I think it's the perfect protagonist, too.
Yeah.
And the perfect setup.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have this man, you know, going into the story within the first 5 or 10 minutes,
yep,
that this is a protagonist who is separated from his wife.
Mm-hmm.
They have a very contentious relationship. They're trying to make it work.
He's a New York cop.
He's a New York cop. He's got a backlog of all these, you know, thugs that he's got to put behind bars.
Uh-huh.
He can't just pick up and move. But you know, as Argyle points out, you're like, oh, so you just thought that she was going to,
right,
you know, try this job out and move right back to New York.
Yeah.
And then it turned into a great career. And he's like, you're very perceptive, Argyle,
right,
you know. And there's hurt. There's hurt coming through John McClane from the moment he arrives on screen.
Mm-hmm.
He, you know, from I'm geeking out on this so hard. When he gets to Nakatomi Tower.
Yeah.
And he's entering.
The touchscreen.
Fast forward to the iPad.
I know.
15 years later. They portended that, you
yeah.
know.
Well, they even felt a need to reference it like, cute
he's
machine
cute
or
toy.
Cute
yeah.
toy.
Yeah. And of course he finds that she's not registered under Holly McClane.
Right.
She's registered under Holly Gennaro.
Yeah. Big deal. Big
huge slap in the face.
Uh-huh.
He's like, yeah, we're separated, but we're not divorced.
Mm-hmm.
And you just, wow.
Yeah.
And the moment he sees her, he's elated. He's dealing with this asshole, Ellis,
mm-hmm.
who's like the epitome of American greed and arrogance.
Yeah. The great Hart Bochner.
Oh, God.
He's so good in this.
There are so many perfect villains in this.
Yeah.
Hans Gruber. Alan Rickman, I think this is the best work he's ever done.
Uh-huh.
And I think he is arguably the best villain of all time in this
man.
Movie. But you also have Hart.
Uh-huh.
You have Ellis, of course. You have Richard Thornburg, the
mm-hmm.
asshole movie producer or a TV producer who also shows up in Ghostbusters.
Yeah, Paul Gleason.
Exactly. Oh, Paul Gleason, uh-huh. of course. I mean, like, the list. Oh, and Robert Davies.
Uh-huh.
Robert Davi?
Yeah.
Am I saying that right? Davey. Robert Davey.
Yeah,
you know,
the FBI guys.
Big Little John. Yeah, Agent uh-huh. Johnson. And like, so all of
and
these.
And Carl, the worst baddie of them all.
Oh, Carl.
Is
and
Carl.
Of course, Alexander Gudinov.
Yeah.
Who is also in Witness.
Yeah.
I realized that when I was watching. I was like, why do I know him? And he was in Witness with Harrison Ford. And like, he has that big moment with the, they're in the middle of town and they get picked on by the, you know, the asshole rednecks.
Uh-huh.
And they're like, And he goes, you know, he's a pacifist. Yeah. He like grabs Harrison Ford's arm. He's like, it's not our way.
Right.
And Harrison's like, it's my way. You know, and just like this fight erupts. And it's just like these, oh, and oh God, what was his name? I wrote this down too. Oh gosh, where is it? Where is it? One of the terrorists is...
You mean one of the Benetton models?
Yeah, exactly. No, Wilhelm von Homburg was Viggo in Ghostbusters 2.
Oh, really?
I couldn't believe it. I was like, I know this guy, but I don't know how. But of course, Viggo, who's in the painting and who comes to life, like I was like, why do I know this guy? And I looked up on IMDb and I was like, oh my goodness.
That's crazy.
But, you know, anyway, I'm sidetracking, but like... From the moment he first sees her in the office, they're elated. They're happy to see each other. They finally get a chance to talk. You know, where are you going to sleep tonight? He doesn't even know if he's going to be sleeping at his house to see his kids.
She says, like, make up the guest room.
Right. But even then, she's like, where are you going to sleep tonight? He's like, I'm going to sleep at my old captain's house.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Well, you could always come over to ours. He's like, oh, you know, I don't know. He's like, I'm not sure that's a good idea. And, you know, then he's like, you know, I really missed you. And he's like, yeah, but you didn't miss my last name, apparently.
He's instantly kind of pissed.
Instantly pissed and instantly goading her.
Yep.
And they have this fight, and it's just heartbreaking because as soon as it's over, she has to go talk to the troops, you know, and, and, you know, she's called out by her secretary to go and, you know, rally everybody. And he immediately regrets it.
Yep.
He immediately hits his head against the door jamb and is like, fuck.
It says so much about the state of their marriage.
Yeah.
Like, you instantly get it.
Yep. And he
especially if you're married or been in a long-term relationship, you're like that thing that I feel like guys do where you're like, fuck, man, can I take back the last 10 seconds?
Yeah.
Because I was just such a dumbass.
Because guys have a tendency to act. This is why I love this movie so much. Guys have a tendency to act tough and feel like they have to be in control all the time.
Yep.
But when they're genuinely hurt by something.
Mm-hmm.
They don't talk about it until it's time to really talk about it. And then it erupts and then they overstep their bounds and they put their foot in their mouth and they're like, shit, I shouldn't have said that.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to say that.
Mm-hmm.
God damn it. I wish I could take that back.
Yep.
But that's the last time he sees her before the terrorists arrive.
Yeah.
Okay. So he's barefoot.
Fist
he's
in his toes.
He's in his A shirt. He's got his trousers on, but that's it.
Yeah.
He's got his pistol and he's only got, you know, full mag luckily, but like.
Sure.
That's it.
Yep.
And then. Shit hits the fan, and he's instantly running up the staircase.
Yeah, he goes into cop mode, and that ticking clock starts. And I was thinking last night, what a brilliant, because everyone thinks they're terrorists. That's sort of the switch of this movie.
Right.
They pretend to be terrorists to throw them off the scent that they're really just thieves. But
I'm an exceptional thief.
But. It was brilliant to make that choice, and I think that was the case in the novel. But because what that does is their robbery has a ticking clock.
Yeah,
it has an end point, and there's a timer going basically, and that just sets the timer for the movie. And anytime anyone's done any screenwriting, like you know, especially a movie like this, like a ticking clock is a big dramatic device.
Definitely.
And if they had been terrorists, they wouldn't have had that ticking clock necessarily.
Yeah. And I think that the tension and the timeline that builds throughout is what makes you sympathize even more with John.
Yeah.
Because throughout, this is a man who, I mean, he started out vulnerable. As the movie goes on, he gets more and more vulnerable. I love the sound. Like, Bruce Willis does not get enough credit for his role in this.
Yeah.
He makes so many strong choices about... sounds like he whimpers.
Yeah.
He whimpers when he gets hit sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
He winces in pain, not just when he's pulling glass out of his foot, but when he's getting hit in the arm. And I think Bruce Willis must have had an actual shoulder surgery because you can see that in his arm clearly.
Yeah.
I think that there, I've seen him in other movies. It looks like he must have had a shoulder surgery. And when he gets punched there, you almost wonder if Bruce Willis is actually crying out in real pain.
Yeah.
When Gudinov and him are, you know, going at it.
He's not the larger than life action star. He's a guy that feels pain, gets hurt. Yes. Shows that he's emotionally hurt at the beginning, which maybe kind of sets that up.
And I would argue that this is the first and maybe the last time in cinema history that we really have a strong yet vulnerable protagonist who is not getting punched and kicked in the face 1,000 times and getting up like nothing happened.
Yeah.
He is crying several times throughout this movie.
Yeah.
He is getting close to his, you know, newfound partner, Niall Powell, Sergeant Al Powell, but like the lovely Reginald Vell Johnson. Oh, I wish he had been in a number of other movies like this.
Yeah.
He did great on Family Matters too, but I would have loved to have seen him in more roles like this. But he has this kinship with a man he cannot see until the end of the movie. They're having this, you know, budding bromance, you know, for over the walkie-talkie.
Yeah.
And even Gruber points out, touching Mr. McLean. Yeah. You know, it's just like there's so many moments where you get to see this guy crack, and he apologizes to Powell. He's like, "Do me a favor, if I don't make it out of this alive, you know, you tell Holly, like, I'm sorry, I was such an asshole. I'm sorry, she's a schmuck, and I tried, you know." And
such a great moment.
He's crying.
Yeah,
and it's real tears, like Bruce Willis. He brings his A game in those moments, and that's what makes it pop. That's what makes this movie so beautiful, is that it's not just some guy who's constantly in charge, constantly knows what to do.
Right.
He's figuring it out at every step of the way. How many terrorists are there? Where are they? What's their
ending? He's writing it down on his arm, that's Marco, such a great little
six.
Tasty bit that they threw in there.
Oh, I mean, he's a detective.
Yeah.
He's a cop. He's figuring stuff out.
Yeah, yeah.
And
he doesn't have all the answers. He's not too cool.
He's not.
Yeah, and he, I think the moment he finds that the radio, like before that point, I think it's underrated what a great acting job he's doing, because he's by himself.
Yeah,
and there are a couple of moments where he's talking to himself, which is a very hard thing to pull off, because people don't do that in real life.
Yeah,
but you know, think, John, think, you know, why didn't you step in there? Because then
you'd be dead too,
you'd
asshole.
Be dead too, asshole. Yeah. And like, people don't do that, and it's hard to pull off in a movie.
Yeah,
but he does. I never thought about it for a second.
Yeah,
but he's by himself for that whole first part. Then he gets that radio, and he gets that landline, that connection to Al, and it just grounds it so much character wise from that point forward. You know, and for the first time now, he gets to interact with Hans.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, their back and forth are just classic.
The Bill Clay.
Yeah.
He's like coming up with his name. What's your name? Bill Clay.
Yeah.
Bill Clay. And it's like, it's funny because it's Rickman being, you know, an Englishman who's doing his best German accent while also infusing it with this, like, hi, I'm Bill Clay. You know?
It's such a bad accent, but maybe that's the point.
I know, and it's wonderful because it's Hans trying desperately to pass himself off as, oh, no, you're one of them. Oh, God. It almost sounds so like John Hurt, like in Alien.
Yeah.
Oh, no, you're one of them, you know? And he has this real, Hans has this moment of vulnerability where he's like, oh, don't kill me, don't kill me.
Yeah.
And it's just these, every little moment is just so well played out. And the thing that also struck me when I watched it again this morning was like, it's funny as hell.
Oh, yeah.
From the moment you're seeing like, fucking California.
Yep.
And you know, when he's, I know the TV dealer feels like he's trapped in the, come out to the coast, have a few laughs.
Well, that line, I remember being a kid and seeing that, come out to the coast, have a few laughs.
Yeah.
And that made me laugh so hard because there hadn't been a ton of funny stuff up until that point.
Uh-huh.
And I just remember that being such a release for the audience.
Yeah.
Of like, oh my God, like we kind of needed that laugh right. in that moment.
And you get to see the villains be vulnerable and real too.
Yeah.
So like, oh, by the way, does the receptionist not look like Huey Lewis?
Yeah.
Like,
he totally
I was
looks
blown
like
away. And I've said this before, but when I watched it, I was like, man, I honestly, when the first time I watched it, I was like, is Huey Lewis one of the terrorists? But it's not, apparently.
It's like he's done some acting.
Yeah, but when Uli, you know, the long-haired terrorist, they're like getting ready to like square off with the cops who are about to, you know, wage war and come in through the main lobby. They've got their rifles all trained at the ready.
Uh-huh.
And he sets himself up by the snack bar.
Yeah.
And it's just like this random moment where he's like, he needs a snack. So he reaches on there and grabs some Junior Mints or whatever.
Those little touches, man.
And the cops who are storming the castle, and one of them gets caught on a thorn.
Yeah.
He gets caught on a rose thorn. He's like, ow.
Uh-huh.
It's like, yeah. Because not everybody's, no one is that tough.
Uh-huh.
No one is that strong. No one is that much of a badass. I love Jason Statham movies for what they are, but that dude gets kicked in the face 100 times. He's getting thrown out of planes. He's getting thrown off of cliffs.
Uh-huh.
He's like, yeah, I'm fine. No worries. Okay. But it's like, and that's awesome.
Uh-huh.
Good for him.
Yeah.
And I love Rambo. They all have a place.
Uh-huh.
Schwarzenegger in Predator, Also, a John McTiernan film, my second favorite action film, but for different reasons.
Predator is?
Predator, yeah, most definitely.
Yeah.
But because of how that's shot and the action in that is perfect.
Yeah.
But every single one of those dudes, Carl Weathers, Jesse Ventura,
right.
You know.
Trying to out-tough one another.
They're out-toughing each other,
yeah.
Which is awesome and a totally different kind of movie. But this movie excels because it is a whole bunch of people, especially John McClane, who are showing their vulnerability.
Yeah.
And that is beautiful.
Yeah.
And it's not ever been done since. I don't think. I really don't think it's ever been done before or since, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, there is a definite, it's sort of a brave thing to do to show the warts and the vulnerabilities of your supposed tough hero and protagonist.
Yep.
And that's why it worked, because you can relate. It's relatable all of a sudden.
Yeah.
And the character is a little more complex. But he still has his, like, the action movie lines. They still give him that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Which is great.
Yeah.
You know.
Okay, Mr. Falcon.
Yeah. So let's talk for a moment about the about Hart Bochner and the scene, his greatest scene. You know, Hans Bubby, like that great scene.
I mean, White Knight.
Yeah. Like, I mean, he does a couple of bumps of blow before he goes in there.
And the hilarious irony of the terrorist offering him a Coca-Cola right after he's done a blow.
I didn't even
notice
that. That's so funny.
Just like, here you go. Here's some more Coke.
Yeah. I never noticed that. Yeah. So, you know, like he's a jackass. He's an asshole.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still something about him where like you don't want him to die.
No,
And you know, I think as soon as he goes in there, this is not going to go well. And John knows that. McClane knows that.
Yeah.
And you hear his desperation. Like, dude, like I think you're an asshole, but fucking get out of there.
Yeah.
Like, you don't know what you're dealing with.
Right.
And such a good scene.
It's beautiful. And there's that tense moment where he's like, John.
Yeah.
He's like looking at Hans.
He gets
Hans,
a little sad. Like, he's oh, like, shit.
And he takes that last sip of Coca-Cola, his last Coke.
He knows it, too.
And then, bam.
Yeah.
You know, it's over.
And you had, and they had, you know, established right out of the gate, which was very important, I think. The first thing that happens is Alexander Gudinov murders two people.
Right.
So that really sets the stakes. Like, these guys are not fucking around.
No.
They're not there to negotiate their way through this. They will kill anybody for any reason.
Yep.
Just very simply because in those first scenes, like, it's way too much trouble to tie these guys up and duct tape their mouth. Like, let's just kill them.
Yeah.
And problem solved.
Right. And I love that there's so many different personalities within the terrorist group. I mean, like,
yeah.
Or it's not, they're obviously not terrorists. They're
it's hard
bad,
to not say that.
The
though.
Bad guys, yeah. Yeah. You've got Theo, who's the brains of the operation, this incredible computer.
My wife last night, she was like, man, he's such a dick.
He's
so smarmy. Well, he's smarmy through the whole thing.
I thought he was endearing, yeah. I really liked him because I thought that he, even those moments where he's like, oh, and the quarterback is toast.
Yeah.
Like, he had some great one-liners too, and Argyle's great. I mean, like, the scene where, I mean, obviously, he takes out, you know, Argyle. Takes him out at the end.
Uh-huh.
It's just this lovely little, like, our guy feels like a badass because he comes in and just punches him. But everybody has these little idiosyncrasies.
Uh-huh.
Like, Gudinov, of course, is like this stoic, just like the epitome of like German or, you know, Eastern European, just like, I feel no pain. Let's just kill everybody.
And I'm not going to run around and do it. I'm going to walk like very slowly through the room with my gun.
Like a snake.
Yeah.
He's like a snake. And somehow he survives being, you know, choked with a chain. And
for 10 minutes.
Marco is this like, I see you, you know, he's got this like, with no more table, you know, like.
That's such a great part.
Crazy. Like, there's so many random, wonderful, his brother, what's Carl's brother's name?
The first kill.
The first kill with the glasses.
Yeah.
He looks like a mannequin.
Nobody is coming to rescue you.
Yes. Of course. Nobody's coming. And then just like everybody has these wonderful outfits, the costume design, the attention to detail from everybody is so specific.
Yeah.
And they hired the Huey Lewis character, obviously, because we need a passable American, because we can't all be, and Theo's obviously American too, but we can't all be Eastern European.
Right.
We have to have some that are passably American, because you need to be the voice for us. You need to be able to like represent us when someone eventually comes.
Yeah.
Like, oh no, it was a false alarm. Don't you worry, you know.
I got my cowboy boots on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he's watching the game and
USC versus Notre Dame, I think, right?
Yeah, boy. Yeah.
Good game.
Well, and then, of course, the I know we're jumping all over the place, but
yeah, sorry.
The way they introduced this is how it goes. The way they introduced Al Powell in the Quickie Mart or whatever, getting his stash of donuts and Little Debbie's, and just his interplay, just all the little moments of this movie are so great. Just that little scene is great.
His
interplay with the cashier.
He knows every ingredient in the Twinkie.
Yeah.
You know, he's like,
bag it.
Bag it. Double bag it. He's like, big time.
Yeah.
It almost sounds, that cashier almost sounds like Jesse Ventura's like, big time.
Yeah.
You know, but it is those little moments, those little human funny moments.
Uh-huh.
Like even with the Johnsons when they're in the helicopter and he's like, this reminds me of Saigon.
Yeah.
And he's like, hey, Slick. And he's like, I was in junior high, big head. Like,
yeah.
You know, like there's just these little, I don't know if it was all beautifully scripted like that. I have to imagine it was, but like if there's moments of improv, good for them too, because like everybody had these beautiful little moments, these little tight little bit acting choices and lines that just added an air of reality to it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I think that's why lines like Hans, Booby, like, all these years later is so quotable. And even the part, and maybe it's because we heard it twice with the recording that the reporter heard, but, you know, they're turning my car into Swiss cheese.
Yeah.
Like that whole moment is so classic.
So it's
now, God damn it, now.
Yeah.
And he drives backwards off the thing.
And I have to imagine that Bruce Willis was allowed to ad-lib a lot of the curse words. Especially when he's fighting.
Yeah.
I don't know if, because I actually turned on the subtitles this morning. I'd never done that before.
Oh, interesting.
But you hear so much more.
Right.
Or you see so much more, I guess, because you're actually able to read the text. But he says to Carl while he's beating him up in that final, you know, fight sequence, he's like, I'm gonna fucking kill you.
Yeah.
I'm gonna chop you up. I'm gonna cook you. I'm gonna eat you. I'm gonna fucking, like, it's like, he's like, I'm going to chop you, I'm going to cook you up, and I'm going to eat you.
I bet you he improved
that. It was like, yeah, I feel like, what?
Yeah.
You know, as you're getting punched in the face, like, it's just brutal. And the fight sequence remind me a lot of Mean Streets, which is one of my favorite Scorsese films, because in the fighting, in that too, it's sloppy as hell.
Yeah.
When you get punched in the face, I don't care who you are. I've been punched in the face. I don't know about you, but it's not a fun feeling.
Yeah.
And you know, especially if you get punched in the nose, your vision gets you know, blurry, your eyes start to water, you're kind of thrown out. No one can take that many punches and be fine.
Yeah.
You know, even the Krav Maga guys who are, you know, getting like trained to get punched in the neck and the face over and over again.
Yeah.
Even you will have a visceral reaction.
Yeah.
So I love that there are moments of real, not just emotional vulnerability, but physical vulnerability from everybody, not just John McClane, but also the villains.
Yeah, you feel the pain of certainly of Bruce Willis, but and even with the feet in the glass, like, she's Dame Vesta, like you know what they're doing. He sees what they're doing, and I think it was such a brilliant choice to not show him walking over the glass.
Yep.
You know he's going to do it, and then the next shot you see of him is picking glass out of his feet. Because there's no choice.
It's a trial by so many trial by fire, literally. He has to go. I mean, it's almost. I would love to break this down from like a religious allegory standpoint. Because I feel like John McClane is this everyman hero who's so flawed. He's not a perfect man. He's made a lot of mistakes. He's said a lot of stupid shit. As Al Powell says, he is alone, tired, and he hasn't seen diddly squat from anyone down here.
Yeah.
Everyone feels like he's fucking it up, up on tower or on floor 30 to 37 on Nakatomi Tower. And he's not getting any love. He's not getting any love whatsoever.
Yeah. He even says, I'm feeling kind of underappreciated right now.
Exactly. I think that he's gone through all these trials, and at the end there's this beautiful moment where he reunites with Holly, and it's gorgeous.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous.
It is.
The payoff is worth it, and she does a great job, too.
Yeah, Bonnie Bedelia.
Bonnie Bedelia was fantastic.
Big shout out to her.
Fantastic in that role.
Yeah.
You know?
She was, and, you know, we were talking about he doesn't have it all figured out, but he's always just one step ahead, whether it's the Bill Clay scene with, you know, he's onto it because, you know, he sees the clay on the board.
Right.
Which, a bit of a stretch, maybe.
Yeah, was it William Clay, wasn't it? I think
it said W.M. Clay.
W.M. Clay, yeah. Clay.
Bill Clinton. Yeah.
But he manages to out-cop them, to out-cop their robber.
Yeah.
But you never get the sense. It's not slick, and it's not like, I'm the guy with all the answers.
Yeah.
Like, you feel the struggle the entire time.
Right. It's not a foregone conclusion like most action films. In most action films, you know the protagonist is going to win. And even in this, you know, because most of these stories end with a happy ending, that this guy's going to win. But you really do struggle with him because he has to work for it.
Yeah.
John McClane is working his ass off to get there. And
it's called Die Hard.
It's called Die Hard, man.
You know, that title, it's on, you know, you just throw it around these days, Die Hard, Die Hard. But it's such a great title.
It really is.
You know?
Yeah.
It just spells it out.
Yeah.
And then one of the great stunts in Hollywood history is the fire hose scene.
Oh, my gosh.
It's just, it's perfect.
I mean, and that's the thing, like, I've seen a lot of movies in the last 10 years where it's CGI heavy, and sometimes they do it very, very well.
Yeah.
And you don't see the strings, and sometimes you see it, you know, and you know they're spending millions of dollars on this, millions and millions of dollars, and it looks like garbage.
Yeah.
And for those people, I say, you know, safety being first and foremost of penultimate importance, fine. But, like, let's make sure, or ultimate importance, rather. I was going to say, yeah, penultimate is the second to last. We need to make sure that we believe this.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as we're doing everything right from a safety perspective, can we make sure that the audience goes there with us?
Mm-hmm.
Can we make sure that we're not having the audience in their chairs being like, oh, I kind of saw the strings with that one.
Right.
I don't really know if I buy that.
Yeah.
Because it takes you out of it.
Yeah, and it's all over after that.
It's all over.
Yeah.
When John jumps off the roof and goes down presumably 10 or 15 floors or so, you know, off this massive balcony and luckily gets, you know, caught in that jetty, you know, it's like you believe it.
Mm-hmm.
You believe every moment, and even when he pushes off and shoots the glass.
So great.
And then goes flying through it, and then he's, you know, getting pulled off.
Yeah.
You believe every moment. And even when Hans falls.
Yeah.
I still don't know how they did that. I mean,
an iconic shot.
I have to believe that not only when the wide shot, when you see him falling.
That's one of the great falls, too.
I think that's a real person. I could be wrong.
I think it is. It's probably an airbag fall.
I would imagine, because the arms are flailing.
Oh, yeah, man.
I can't imagine that was an animatronic robot. I think that was a real person, unless it was just an incredible dummy that they rigged to move a certain way.
No, I bet
way.
It was.
But even the bird's eye view shot of John looking down on Hans, of all this, you know, destruction beneath, it's like Hans is literally going to descend into hell.
Yeah.
And he's looking up just in super slow-mo, and he's about to get the shot off. And then that moment where he gets Holly's watch off.
Yeah.
And it's fully acknowledged in that split second in Hans's brain that it's over.
Uh-huh.
Like, once the watch is off, I'm done.
Yeah.
And it's that oh shit moment.
Mm-hmm.
And it reads so beautifully on his face.
Yeah.
I mean, I wish I could have met Alan before he passed so that I could have just thanked him for this role alone. And for moments like that, because, like, that's what made me want to be an actor. Being able to, in whatever the scenario, like, believably take the audience to the place you need to go to so that they feel something that visceral.
Right.
Because for me, I don't know about you, but I have a massive fear of falling. I have dreams about falling all the time.
Oh, interesting.
I don't know what that means, but constantly waking up where I feel like I've been falling.
Uh-huh.
And the great maybe it came from this movie, I don't know, because it left such an impression, but like the constant fear of like losing the ground beneath you and knowing on some level that you're going to die
because you're alive on the way down
and the acceptance of that do you embrace it, do you know that's got to be the scariest thing on the planet and he conveyed that so beautifully.
It's I've got 4 seconds to live.
Yeah.
Or depending on where you're falling from.
And he's thwarted.
Yeah.
And his brilliant, brilliant plan is over.
Yeah.
And he lost.
Because of a gun taped to the back of the protagonist.
And that's the other thing, too. Like, John is constantly figuring out ways to make this work.
Mm-hmm.
He's in an impossible situation, but he only has his one pistol. He doesn't have whole bunch of weapons. He accumulates more as time goes on. He obviously gets the C4. He gets some automatic rifles.
It's almost like a video game at times in that way, like collecting the weapons.
Yeah, it's like Wolfenstein. You start out with the crappy little P-38, and then you're like, oh, crap. What am I going to do with this?
Yeah.
And you collect some frag grenades. And you're like, oh, great.
Right.
And then you're like, oh, cool, bazooka. Great. And a shotgun. Nice. Uh-huh. But it's beautiful in that regard, and he's figuring it out. He's piecing it all together. Like, how do I make this work? The first 911 call didn't work. Maybe I can get on the walkie and get over to dispatch again.
Yeah,
and
a fucking guy out the window.
Throw a guy out the window. Hit Al's car. Uh-huh. I didn't think he needed to shoot up Al's car though. Like, that was excessive. Like, I was like, John, you made your point when you threw a guy out the window on his hood. Like, you could have just left it there. I don't think he needed to be shooting up the top of his like. That was excessive, and I think he could have actually killed or, you know, very seriously hurt Al. So I think that was excessive, but he needed to get his point across, I suppose.
Well, you're so all in at this movie that at the end, when he shoots both the guys, you totally buy him blowing the smoke from the gun like an old Western and saying, yippee-ki-yay, Mr. Falcon.
Yeah. And that was watching it again, like, I forgot how long they laugh at that line.
Yeah.
When Rickman's like, what was it you said to me again? Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
Yeah.
And he says it with this weird, like, motherfucker.
Uh-huh.
And then they have this, like, 30-second laugh, like, break where they're like,
right.
And it's just, and then Huey Lewis, I don't know that actor's name, but the Huey Lewis lookalike is standing there, and they all just start laughing, and Bonnie Bedelia's like, what the fuck is going on? Why are you all laughing at this? Like, I'm pretty sure one of us or a few of us are going to die in this moment.
Yeah, they do take it to an extreme level.
To an extreme level, but it somehow works. And then that moment where he just goes, Holly reaches behind his neck, grabs the gun.
She sees it coming and ducks.
Boom, Huey Lewis, you're dead. Shoots Hans in the chest.
Yeah. Over. Such a cathartic ending. Mm-hmm. Well, what you think is the ending.
What you think, but good enough.
Man.
He's good enough for me. I'll tell you, that guy. Oof.
He's hung by the neck for in real time, probably 10 or 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Because everyone's there and he's talking to Al and, well, the brilliance, too, of giving Al the truly heroic moment.
Yeah.
I mean, you didn't even need to do all that.
No. Nope.
But that just adds another layer because we hear the story about why he is has been removed, I guess.
From active duty, yeah.
Yeah, from active duty because he shot the kid. And that beautiful shot of the gun barrel lowering and that rack focus to his face.
And Reginald Vail Johnson has so much emotion in that moment, too.
So much.
It's a cathartic moment for him of like, I save the day and I also redeem myself in the eyes of myself and probably the Force and maybe obviously saving John and Holly, but like he needed that.
He did.
He killed a kid accidentally.
Right.
You know, and I'm sure the weight of that, the guilt of that has been so squarely in him for so many years. And in this moment, he finally gets to let it go.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Well, and everyone gets their moment, like, but it never feels like, oh, just let me tidily tie this up.
Right.
Like, Argyle gets his moment.
Yeah.
Al gets his moment. Bonnie Bedelia.
Holly gets her moment.
Punches the reporter.
With Thornburg, yeah.
Yeah, like everyone, everyone gets their little moment in the end.
I'm glad you brought that up, too, because I feel like this movie portended or maybe even, like, gave the idea to, like, Rupert Murdoch of, like, 24/7 news coverage.
Oh, interesting.
You know? Because, like, this was, like, the first movie that I can think of where we see media so clearly having a presence throughout the film, whether it's going back to the studio with that idiot asshole.
Eat it, Harvey.
Harvey, yeah. Harvey, you know, as in Stockholm, Finland. Right. Or Sweden. Finland,
that
actually.
Was really funny.
You know, like, just these wonderful little moments of, like, making sure that the media is an ever-present part of the storyline, because then we get to see a different side of it. And then you get to see the kids at home with the nanny, and you, Holly, realizes, like, you just jeopardized all of our lives because you wanted a story, because you wanted to, you know, win a Pulitzer for this. And I'm going to, or Peabody, whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's like, and you're going to jeopardize my life. And she just has this moment. She comes up and clocks him.
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
It's great.
And then Thorn was like, did you get that? You
know,
like,
yeah.
Just, and I just think this movie, like, really was so revolutionary and genuinely predicted a lot of things that were going to happen. It predicted the iPad.
Uh-huh.
It predicted 24/7 news coverage.
Yeah.
It predicted Bruce Willis's career, obviously.
Yeah, launched him into superstardom.
Superstardom.
Yeah.
And I love that, like, he's even referencing there's references to Rambo, uh-huh. Schwarzenegger. There's, like, Roy Rogers, obviously, yep. Gary Cooper. There's references to Hollywood within the movie, which uh-huh. usually makes me cringe.
Yeah, yeah.
But in this, it works
mm-hmm.
somehow.
Yeah. Well, because you're all in.
Yeah.
Oh, man. What a great movie.
It's the best. It's the best action movie of all time, one of the best Christmas movies of all time.
Yeah.
It is my favorite Christmas song of all time.
Yeah, Ode to Joy.
Christmas and Hollis.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
By Run DMC.
Yeah.
That is my favorite Christmas song of all time, because uh-huh. most Christmas music in my mind is kind of awful.
Yeah.
But, like, this song is brilliant. And just, like, the way you started out with Argyle putting this on in
yeah.
limo, driving into the sunset of West LA,
yeah.
Nakatomi Tower in the distance.
Yeah, oh, gorgeous.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
That, like, fire red sky.
Yeah, all that pollution that just makes yeah. the sunset just really pop, you know? Oof.
Boy, did we do it?
I mean,
you got anything else on your list?
Gosh, I could talk about this for hours, but I think that's most of what I got through, I think.
Epic fight with Carl, man. That thing's intercut. It feels like it takes 15 minutes.
Mm.
So great.
Yeah. I really don't have much more to add. I just think it's a perfect movie.
Yeah.
I mean, there's little things that you could nitpick and be like, no, I didn't really buy that hit, or, you know, when
I think I know what you're about to say. Go ahead.
Well, in the staircase, when he kills the
guy. There's some bad stunt doubling in that shot.
Well, also, there's like, when they add the sound effect for his neck breaking, it uh-huh. comes too late. So it doesn't make sense. Like, it should have yeah. happened on a step prior.
And it's almost a minor Wilhelm scream.
Right.
It's kind of like, ugh.
And then, but if they had just moved that sound effect a second earlier, it would have worked. But yeah, but these are nitpicky things.
Sure. Like, and it's kind of funny as an adult to be like, oh my God, this, like, the stunt doubles are terrible in
right.
that shot.
But also, you
but
still
as a kid,
buy it.
I didn't notice it. You
yeah.
know?
And the good, when Hans says to Carl, like, we're back in business. And Carl does this, like, Vida Sassoon turn to the camera with his blonde flowing hair just uh-huh. all over the place.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so extra. It's so yeah. unnecessary.
I know.
But you're like, God, I love it. I don't know why I love it. It's those McTiernan moments.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we know in Predator, when Jesse Ventura would pull out the minigun and be like, son of a bitch. You know, like, yeah. these like, tiny little moments that are so macho and unnecessary.
Uh-huh.
But when coupled with and in sharp contrast to the vulnerability of our protagonist,
yeah.
you're like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous and I love it.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's just, I it's one of those few movies. Like, this movie is not my favorite film of all time. That's 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Right.
But this is my favorite movie of all time.
Yeah.
And this is a movie that if it's on, unless I have to go to work mm-hmm. or unless there's a pressing engagement, I have to stop what I'm doing and I watch all of Die Hard.
Yeah. It's one of those for me too.
Yeah.
Did you see any of the sequels?
Oh, yeah, of course.
I thought the third one with Sam Jackson was really good.
Also directed by John McTiernan.
Oh, okay. Did he leave the second one?
Yeah. That was, oh, gosh.
What
he
director?
He did Castaway Island, or no, Cutthroat Island.
Oh,
Rennie
Harlan?
Rennie Harlan, yes. Yeah, I know.
No wonder it wasn't great.
I mean, I liked it because it was set in Denver.
Oh,
so
that's
that
right.
That was a fun little... You know,
you're like, the next Die Hard is set in Denver.
I was like, oh! me? And that was just a little joy. And plus, you know, like, that was a cool villain, you know.
Yeah.
Not nearly as cool as Hans, but there were some great moments in that.
I really enjoyed the third one, though. I thought that was good. The
third one was really solid.
And I don't even think I saw the more recent one.
I did. I think there were a massive departure, and that was the more Fast and the Furious Die Hards,
mm-hmm.
which I don't care for.
Yeah.
I mean, I just feel like the thing that makes this movie great, specifically the first Die Hard, and in Die Hard 2 when he gets the, you know, he ejects out of the
yeah.
plane, it's like, oh, he would never survive that.
Yeah.
It's dumb. Like, what made the first Die Hard so wonderful was that you believe the action,
yep.
you got a vulnerable protagonist, and you go on that journey with him, and with those, it's kind of like an action figure.
Yeah, it's hard to recapture that because mm-hmm. it's truly a lightning in the bottle kind of thing.
But in Die Hard with a Vengeance,
yeah.
you got a little bit more of that.
Yep.
And I think it's because they went back to you know, John McTiernan and said, let's get the magic back.
Yeah.
And you got Jeremy Irons as this also brilliant,
yeah.
you know, brother to Hans Gruber.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, okay.
I'm a big fan of scavenger hunts, too.
Yeah.
So that aspect of the movie.
That
Simon
Says aspect. Uh-huh. I mean, and the interplay between Samuel Jackson and Bruce Willis was perfect.
Yeah,
I mean,
great.
Like, absolutely perfect. And addressing some racial issues, mm-hmm. racial tension too, just yeah. on a very subversive level, like really going into some stuff that is not addressed in a lot of action movies, frankly, yeah. you know? They didn't have to do that.
Agreed.
But they went there.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Hey, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. As a nostalgic voice from your past, I'm here to remind you that amongst the stressful and chaotic existence we live in 2024, you deserve to get away. It's time for a vacation, no matter when you're hearing this. And let me tell you how you'll get there. The 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe. Want to bring the family to the mountains with the Santa Fe's available H-Track all-wheel drive? Well, it's got standard third-row seating and available dual wireless charging pads for the kids who just want to stare at their phone and not talk to you. You know what I mean. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This summer, click into Memorial Day savings at the Home Depot and get after those outdoor projects with some serious cordless power from Ryobi. Tackle more than half an acre of grass with the convenience and gas-like power of the Ryobi 40-volt battery-powered mower. Leaves and debris are no match for the 40-volt power of the Ryobi leaf blower. No cords, no gas, no hassle. Tidy up those flower beds and keep your walkways looking sharp with Ryobi's 40-volt cordless string trimmer. Yard work, done and done. Click into Memorial Day savings happening now at your cordless power source, the Home Depot. Shop now at the Home Depot or homedepot.com. How doers get more done.
All right, we finished with two segments.
Okay.
What Ebert said.
This movie is a complete disappointment.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then five questions.
I'm fascinated to hear what Ebert had to say.
Well, Ebert gave it 2 stars and was a bit of a dick about it.
Whoa. He gave it 2 stars?
Yeah, this is a bit longer than usual, the pull quote. But
was this before Thumbs Up?
Well, this was his column,
oh.
which he didn't thumb the column. That was just
wow.
for the TV show. So he had this to say. He talks a little bit about it and sort of liking it. Then he says, but then the filmmakers introduce a gratuitous and unnecessary additional character, Deputy Police Chief, the Paul Gleason character, who doubts that the guy on the other end is really a New York cop at all. As nearly as I can tell, the deputy chief is in the movie for one purpose, to be consistently wrong at every step of the way and provide a phony counterpoint to the progress. The character is so willfully useless, so dumb, so much a product of the idiot plot syndrome, which he capitalizes, by the way,
yeah.
That all by himself, he successfully undermines the last half of the movie. Disagree. Thrillers like this need to be well-oiled machines with not a single wasted moment. Inappropriate and wrong-headed interruptions reveal the fragile nature of the plot and prevent it from working. Without the deputy chief and all he represents, Die Hard would have been more than a passable thriller. With him, it's a mess, and that's a shame because the film does contain superior special effects, impressive stunt work, and good performances.
I can see his point there.
Yeah,
but
he's wrong.
Yeah, but also it's like that's the hubris of the police force too. It was, Gleason represented, Dwayne, what was his name?
Oh, in the movie?
Deputy Dwayne.
Yeah. Casey?
No. Maybe. But, you know, yeah, that sounds about right. But I think that he needed to be there too, is the arrogance of the police force. Like, mm-hmm. We know what we're doing. Oh, Christ, it could be a bartender for all we know, Powell.
Yeah.
You know, like,
it's a bit of a trope, but I bought it.
It is a trope, but it works because also I love certain things about the 80s tropes. It's a beautiful time capsule. I mean, look at the character of Ellis. I mean, like, he is the epitome
yeah.
of arrogant, greedy 80s,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that if you don't have that, idiot or someone who's a little bit inept at their job, who's just kind of going guns blazing, then you don't get to see the real beauty of John. You don't get to see the real beauty of Al Powell, who's trying to be more measured in his approach and saying, should we go in guns blazing or should we a little back off and just kind of
it allows Al to be the smartest guy on the scene.
Yep.
Smarter than the FBI, smarter, you know, they're shooting at the lights. Like,
yep.
I thought it was great. I had no problem with that character.
Yeah. I mean, he's a dick, but I don't think he was.
All of them are idiots except for Al.
Yeah. I mean, I think he didn't detract from the storyline for me.
Yeah.
He really didn't. Either. Even after viewing this for the, God, I don't even know how many times I've seen this movie.
It's hard to count.
It is hard to count. I should really keep a tally from now on. But
write it on your arm and Sharpie.
Get some tattoos like Memento. It's a small thing to nitpick, and I think he missed the overall value of the movie, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But, you know, can't be right about all of them
either. No, all respect. I've had a few in here where I thought he was dead wrong on, so.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, and then we finish with five questions with Ross Marquand. Is it Marquand?
Marquand.
Oh, jeez. I've been saying Marquand.
That's okay.
Marquand.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
French.
Okay. Of course it is. First movie you remember seeing in the theater?
Oh, Spaceballs.
Oh.
Yeah.
All right. That's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
First R-rated movie. Did you have restricted viewing as a Methodist like I did?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I couldn't even watch beyond PG-13.
All right. Yeah, same here.
First R-rated movie I think I saw was Pulp Fiction. Oh, I hope I'm not indicting my brother here in this, but my brother's friend had snuck a little video camera and into
pirated, huh?
Very much, and it was awful quality.
Yeah, that's not a good way to see.
But I think that was the first R-rated movie I saw was Pulp Fiction. I was 13.
Via pirated copy.
Via pirated copy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Number three. Will you...
I shouldn't be admitting that.
I think the statute of limitations. Probably.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you will you walk out of a bad movie?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Do you remember doing so recently?
Oh. Yeah,
the last one?
I mean,
do you
the last one I walked out of, and this was more just because I was starting to have a terrible headache, was Rambo from 2007. And I love the Rambo movies, but I genuinely started, I got a migraine from all the super, super quick edit points and flashes and the sounds. It just gave me a migraine, so I had to walk out of there. Yeah.
Are you a migraine sufferer?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Sorry to hear that.
That's okay.
I got some friends that's the worst. This one is tailored to, the guest. So is there an impossible impression?
Oh yeah.
Is there a white whale out there that.
Mine is Ryan Gosling.
Ah.
He's so subtle and he's Canadian, but he does this in most of his movies. I feel like he's trying to do like this faux Brooklyn accent in most of his movies. And I don't know where he got that from because I don't think any dialect that I've studied from Canada sounds like this. But
yeah.
I feel like he came over to the States early enough or maybe he spent some time in Brooklyn or maybe he felt like he had to sound
a
little – or maybe that's just genuinely how his voice is. But I've never been able to master it and I've tried for years.
And you're still working on it?
Oh, yeah.
Interesting.
I'll never give up.
Yeah.
I'll keep
– Oh, really?
I'll keep trying Gosling until I'm in the ground. But he's the toughest. He's the toughest.
Wow. All right. Interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, man. We didn't even talk about Red Skull.
Oh, yeah.
Way to go.
Thanks.
You're part of the MCU.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks. That's crazy.
That was pretty cool, huh?
It was. Yeah. That's, you know, aside from church. So it was church, Boy Scouts, and Marvel. Like, I went to Mile High Comics. I don't know if it's still there. I mowed lawns a lot when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And I would collect all of the Marvel comic book cards. Like, I have Marvel series 1 through 3, and then Marvel Masterpieces. I ended around, like, 95, 96 when Fleet did their spinoff, and then I had, like, some of DC.
Uh-huh.
Didn't collect as much of the comics because that was, like, a huge investment.
Yeah.
But I would read them. I would go. They'd allow you to read them, but, like, they wouldn't allow – I mean, like, as long as you bought some cards when you were there, like,
right,
they'd allow you to
read
stay
a few.
There. Yeah. But, like – any amount of money that I made, it went directly to collecting those cards. I have so many. It's absurd.
So you got that call and they're like, you could probably do a Hugo Weaving and was that just like,
yeah,
pinch,
I mean,
yourself?
I was blown away. I mean, cause I just thought it was just going to be, you know, doing the, you know, quick little voice match or they wanted me to sound like him.
Uh-huh.
But maybe it was for a different character because I naturally assumed that Hugo was going to come back.
Right.
And I don't know the details as to why he didn't want to. But,
I think I read that he just didn't want to.
Yeah. I mean,
It might have been that simple.
Might have been that simple, yeah. But I was really honored because I grew up, like, Red Skull is like one of the oldest villains of all time. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I think he came out in 1941, his first appearance, I want to say. He was basically used as Nazi war propaganda, you know, like, or anti-Nazi war propaganda for the allied, young allied soldiers to join up and join the cause. So fight against Red Skull and Hitler, you know. And I used to draw him. I used to draw him and Sabretooth and Omega Red and Wolverine. Like, those were my, like, four or five, like, favorite characters to draw. Mm-hmm. And when I got the word that I was going to be playing him, I was like, you got to be kidding me. I mean, granted, it's like, it's 2 minutes in the movie, but I would be just in costume and be totally fine with that, you know?
Yeah.
So it was, I'm still blown away.
So cool.
Pitching myself, yeah.
So you were here for that too, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
Man. I'm glad I got that in because people would have been so mad if I would have forgotten to it. Can you give us a little Red Skull?
Oh, God. My voice is shot. I'm sorry. I don't want to.
No, that's all right.
I won't do it justice.
You don't want to disrespect Red Skull.
Yeah.
All right. And finally, movie going 101. What is your ritual? Where do you sit? What do you do at the concession stand? How do you do it?
If I'm in LA, I go to the Vista Theater.
I know it well.
You know
it
well? Yeah.
And a lot of guests, we all talk about our love of the Vista.
It's the best.
I used to live right down the street.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh, nice. Like Los Feliz or where were you? Yeah. Okay.
Sort of like Los Feliz adjacent, Vermont and Santa Monica.
Okay. Yeah. I was Alvarado and Wilshire. I was like MacArthur Park.
Nice.
And there really weren't, back in 2005 when I first moved to LA, like there weren't good theaters around there. So I would always hightail it up to the Vista. And to this day, like that's my favorite place to watch a movie because it's so... I mean, that theater is just, it's history, you know, it's living history. And, I don't really do the concessions because I'm just worried that like, if I have anything to drink or eat, I'm going to, you know, need to run out and use a bathroom.
But, right.
I sometimes do popcorn. I'm a very polite, like quiet. I don't make noise. I don't make sound. I'm very like, I'm just analyzing it the whole time. Mm. You know, if I ever do decide to talk about it, it'll be afterwards. And then I want to talk a lot about it.
Right.
But during the movie, I cannot stand when people ask questions or talk about it because I'm like, I'm sure it'll be revealed if you wait 5 minutes.
Right.
You know? But I just believe that like theater etiquette has just completely gone by the wayside in recent years. It's really crazy.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Good stuff, man.
All right.
This was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks for being on. All righty, everybody, we did it. Man, what a fun one. I think this will go down as one of the great Movie Crush interviews because conversations, rather, because all the great stuff, man, all that fun impression stuff. And then I'm just going to go ahead and say it. I would say, dare I say, one of the great conversations about Die Hard ever recorded for podcasts. I've never heard any other ones, but I'm going to go ahead and throw this one in the top five. We got into it, and that was a lot of fun. Ross is a fun, nice guy, and very generous with his time, and very generous to indulge me with all the impressions. And it was kind of fun to talk about the art of impressions and get into that a little bit. It's very cool. As someone who considers himself a very much an amateur impressionist, it was kind of nice to see someone who really knows what they're doing and know that he works on it and that it is a craft. And what a great story, man. Very, very happy for his success, as I'm sure you are as well. I hope he continues on The Walking Dead and he doesn't get eaten by a zombie for many years to come. I hope they make another Red Skull movie and that he gets to be in it. We talked about that afterward. That would be really great for Ross. And I just wish him continued success in the years to come. So that is it for this week. Hope you enjoyed yourselves. And until next time, yippee-ki-yay, Mr. Falcon. Movie Crush is produced, engineered, edited, and soundtracked by Noel Brown and Ramsey Yunt at How Stuff Works Studios, Ponce City Market, Atlanta, Georgia.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Managing your diabetes just got easier. The powerful new Dexcom G7 lets you see your glucose numbers on your compatible watch and phone without fingersticks. And because Dexcom G7 is the most accurate CGM system, you can be confident in your food, exercise, and medication decisions. And all those decisions can lead to big results, like more time in range and lower A1C. Get started at Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com/compatibility.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.